Good evening. I'm Terry Wing in Washington. This is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, the inquiry into the Korean ferry disaster now focuses on the captain and crew. Hopes for finding that missing Malaysian jetliner are fading after 5 weeks of futility. And a report on how little has changed in the lives of Afghanistan's and Pakistan's women. Those stories and more in the next half hour on Crossroads Asia. The high school vice principal who was rescued from the sunken South Korean ferry was found hanging from a tree today. Kang Min-kyu was on board the ferry along with more than 300 students from the Answan Danwon High School. He was among the first survivors to be rescued. Police said he apparently hanged himself with a belt from a tree near a gymnasium in Jindo, where relatives of missing passengers have been camped out. It's just the latest tragic turn following the ferry sinking, which remains unexplained. As the death toll from the disaster rose to 28, hopes of finding the roughly 270 people still missing dimmed further when the entire boat became submerged underwater today. Until then, part of the ship's blue and white hull was still poking out of the frigid waters of the Yellow Sea. Officials say that there's a chance for good air pockets inside the ship, and divers raced to reach hundreds of people believed to be inside. The Coast Guard says rescue workers managed to breach the hull of the sunken ferry, and two divers managed to enter the second deck on the cargo deck, but rough waters forced them back out again. They didn't find any bodies in their brief search. The families of the missing passengers are furious at the government because of what they say is the slow pace of the rescue effort. Many of them lashed out in frustration at President Park Geun-hye during an impromptu meeting on the island of Jindo near the crash site. Ms. Park tried to reassure the distraught families that authorities are doing everything possible in their search and rescue mission. The unfolding situation in South Korea is raising concern about the safety of such vessels and whether the crew responded properly. VOA correspondent Steve Herman in our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok reports international maritime accident specialists are expressing confidence that an investigation will determine the tragedy's cause.
It is not only bereaved families questioning how so many could be stranded on board a ship that capsized and sank in relatively shallow water close to a coastal island. South Korea's Coast Guard is still focused on retrieving the bodies of those inside the vessel and those being found floating in the sea. But preliminary information from investigators reveals the five-story-tall ferry on a voyage from Incheon to the resort island of Jeju made a sudden, sharp turn some minutes before the first distress call Wednesday morning. Former ferry boat captain Kit Fallor in Australia cautions against jumping to any conclusions prior to a full investigation of the sinking of the ferry named Sewol.
The sudden turn may be because somebody on the bridge or the course altered suddenly, or it may have been from an external source, such as the loss of watertight integrity may have caused in itself the instability of the ship. What we really need, a thorough investigation, objective investigation, which I know that the Korean authorities will conduct. They are very expert in these sorts of areas.
Filor says ferries like the Sewol that can carry vehicles and so are called roll-on, roll-off ferries or ro-ros have been involved in numerous high-profile accidents with significant loss of life. But Filor, who has taught courses in numerous countries on conducting maritime accident investigations, says the ships themselves are not inherently dangerous.
Most of the accidents that occur to ro-ros, I think, really occur because of an external source, such as a fire, collision, a door being left open. Normally, though, if they are operated in reasonable sea conditions and within the regulations that govern them, they are a safe form of transport.
The diesel-powered Sewol, built in Japan in 1994, was capable of carrying nearly 1,000 people and dozens of cars and trucks. It sank within 2 hours of sending its initial distress signal. More than 300 of the 475 people on board were teenage students on a school trip. Officials say the third mate was apparently at the wheel when the accident happened. The captain is in police custody. There are reports from survivors that the captain and most of the crew abandoned ship without even telling passengers to flee for their lives. Those who were on the topmost and lowest decks apparently had the best opportunities to escape. Some of those rescued say an announcement was repeatedly broadcast on the ship telling passengers to stay put, even an hour after the first distress call and less than 90 minutes before the 14-meter-high vessel completely capsized. The incident is likely to become South Korea's worst maritime disaster in decades. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
As Steve Herman reported, there are still many questions about the accident and the officials in charge. Why did that big ship make a sharp turn before listing? What about the reports of a loud bang moments before the ferry began to turn? Sam Bateman is a retired Commodore in the Royal Australian Navy. He cautions against making any firm conclusions this early in the investigation. But he tells us the problem could be related to the stern or rear door of the ship, which allows vehicles and other large cargo to enter.
I suspect from the descriptions with this Korean vessel, and there's been talk of this bang business, is that that stern door on the ferry, that somehow was given away?
If water did in fact begin to enter through the stern door, Bateman says it could lead to an effect known as a free surface, in which water sloshes around the deck, causing the craft to become unstable.
If you try and carry a big flat oven tray of water or something like that, and you sort of tilt it to one side, it becomes off balance very easily. And that's a particular weakness with ferries, because once you get a little bit of water into a vehicle deck and the ship's rolling a bit, it's very easy then for the water to create the free surface, which creates the listing moment for the ship.
The stern door theory would help explain why such a large ship capsized so quickly, but it does not account for why the door would have given way the first place. One possibility is that an item of large cargo, such as one of the 150 cars on the ship, came loose. But Bateman says this seems unlikely given the reported conditions at the time of the sinking.
It doesn't seem to have been particularly rough. So, I mean, there shouldn't have been a case of, you know, some like a unsecured vehicle or something like that, moving a container or something within the vehicle deck. I wouldn't have thought that would have been the case. I'd suspect more it's been some structural failure in the vessel itself.
Bateman, a senior fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore, says he doesn't believe the vessel struck an uncharted rock, saying investigators would probably have located that rock by now. But he does say many ferry operators, particularly in developing countries, could improve the standards meant to avoid overcrowding. He says passengers should also be given better pre-departure evacuation guidance.
When you fly in an aircraft, you know, you get that pre-flight briefing, you know, how to put on your life jacket. And, of course, I also talk about looking at your nearest exit route and all that sort of stuff. That rarely happens in a ferry.
U.S. President Barack Obama on Thursday sent his condolences to the families of the victims of the accident. Mr. Obama is due to visit Korea next week during an 8-day, 4-country tour of Asia that begins April 23rd. He said he will pay tribute during his stop there. He also said the U.S. military will provide the country with any help it needs to perform rescue operations. He said American Navy personnel and U.S. Marines are already on the scene assisting with the search and rescue efforts. Now on to the latest on the search to find that missing Malaysian jetliner. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott says a robotic submarine scanning the Indian Ocean floor for the plane will finish its current search within a week. Mr. Abbott told the Wall Street Journal if the so-called Bluefin 21 submarine does not find any wreckage by then, authorities will stop, regroup, and consider how to proceed. The Australian agency coordinating the search said the vehicle completed its first full 16-hour mission after two previous missions were cut short because of technical problems. The Bluefin 21 has so far searched 90 square kilometers of the Indian Ocean, but authorities say they have found no significant detection in the sonar data collected. U.S. Navy officials had previously warned it could take up to 2 months for the submarine to scan the current 600 square kilometer search area. Meanwhile, 12 aircraft and 11 ships were involved in the search, looking for floating debris from the missing Boeing 777. Australian officials have warned this effort will soon be called off since no debris has been found since the plane went missing more than 5 weeks ago. It is unclear how authorities will proceed if the surface search is called off and the robotic submarine does not locate any underwater wreckage. It's been more than a week since authorities last detected a signal that they believe came from a locator beacon on the plane's flight data recorder. The recorder's batteries are now presumed to have run out of power. The black box signals helped narrow that search area considerably, but search crews are still dealing with a target area of more than 40,000 kilometers in size. An avalanche on Nepal's Mount Everest has killed at least a dozen local guides. Several other guides were rescued, while others are still missing. An official with Nepal's tourism ministry said all the victims were Sherpa guides working on the mountain in preparation for the start of the climbing season. The official said the avalanche occurred about 6:30 in the morning, Friday time, in an area called the Popcorn Field. The major avalanche is the first of the climbing season at the world's highest peak and deadliest ever on Everest. Thousands of climbers have scaled the mountain since Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay completed the first ascent back in 1953, but nearly 250 people have lost their lives. An excerpt from a Pulitzer Prize report posted online by a website in Thailand has led to a criminal court case against two journalists in the country. They're accused of defaming the Thai Navy for its alleged involvement in trafficking of some refugees from Burma. We're joined again by VOA correspondent Steve Herman in Bangkok.
An Australian editor based in Thailand and one of his local reporters appeared in a provincial court and were released on bail. The Navy filed charges against them 5 months ago after they posted a paragraph from a Reuters news story which alleged that members of the Thai military profited from trafficking of Muslim Rohingya asylum seekers from Burma. The two journalists who were charged work for an online English language news site on the Thai southern resort island of Phuket. Alan Morrison is the editor of the Phuket Wan website. He says his independent website was likely targeted because it has repeatedly reported about how the Rohingya refugees have been treated by Thai authorities. However, he says it is not unique for officials here to try to intimidate journalists and others in this way.
The law is used in all kinds of bad ways against investigative journalists and academics and even migrant activists in Thailand already. And we're just the most noticeable case, I guess, because it's the military.
After being granted bail, Morrison was ordered by the court not to leave Thailand. The other journalist charged in the case is Chutima Sidasatian. She expresses relief about being granted bail after being held in the court's detention cell for 5 hours. Chutima says she and her editor will fight the case. Chutima also helped Reuters with its series on the plight of the refugees. The Reuters articles were this week awarded a Pulitzer Prize for international reporting. Reuters says the same Thai Navy officer who brought the case against the two journalists has also filed a criminal complaint against the news agency, which is believed to be under review by Thai authorities. Morrison and Chutima face up to 7 years in prison and a fine of about $3,000 if convicted of both defamation and offenses under the Computer Crimes Act. Human Rights Watch, an international non-governmental organization, is calling on Thailand's leaders to intervene and stop the case. It terms the prosecution an application of draconian laws and a blatant violation of media freedoms. The Foreign Correspondents Club of Thailand on Thursday issued a statement saying it shares the view of the UN Human Rights Commissioner that such a prosecution serves only to stifle media freedom on an issue of profound importance to the rights of persecuted people. The journalist organization adds the legal action damages Thailand's image and claims the country may make in support of freedom of speech and fair comment. The provincial court has set a May 26th date for the first hearing in the case. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
The members of the Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in North Korea addressed members of the UN Security Council in an informal meeting late Thursday. Afterwards, Commission head Michael Kirby told reporters the Security Council must use its authority to refer North Korea to the International Criminal Court. It was the first time the UN Security Council discussed the issue of human rights in North Korea. Russia and China did not attend the meeting, but Kirby said there was strong support for an ICC referral from at least 9 of the 13 members who did attend. Prolonged conflicts in Pakistan and Afghanistan have had a particularly harsh effect on women in both countries. Sharon Bain talks to analysts on how terrorism, sectarian conflict, criminality, and a culture of impunity are limiting women's ability to get to school and to get jobs outside of the home and trapping them in an even smaller public space.
During the past decade, women have made significant strides towards social, political, and financial empowerment in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. But analysts say the gains are being threatened. In Afghanistan, the Taliban are regaining areas of the country and once again imposing their beliefs that women should not be educated or participate in society outside the home. Nader Nadiri, director of the Afghanistan Research and Evaluation Unit, says in areas where there is an absence of rule of law, there is an absolute impunity for those who are committing violence, specifically against women. In those areas, he says, protection becomes a primary issue, but is often used against the women themselves.
In some cases, the protection issues becomes an excuse for the male members who intentionally prevents women to be part of the society, be part of the economy, be part of the politics, and they bring this issue of, I'm pushing you at the home because I want you to be protected. This is what the Taliban were trying to do and still are doing.
Pakistani social researcher Nazish Brohi says in areas where the Pakistani Taliban operate or have influence, girls are being targeted and women are retreating behind the veil and into their houses.
I think over 500 girls' schools have been bombed. Women counselors, which were women who were politically engaged, who were elected into office, they were specifically threatened by the Taliban and asked to either stop and withdraw from the political sphere or face persecution. Two of them were shot dead. As a result, the rest of the women either resigned or just simply stopped attending office.
In Pakistan's south and southwest, ethnic violence also has forced women to cover their faces and severely curtailed their social mobility. Brohi says with the overall deterioration of the rule of law in Pakistan, women no longer feel the state can protect them. Instead, they are turning to family or local neighborhood councils for help and protection.
The central concept really seems to be impunity, that the state is unwilling to call these aggressors or perpetrators of crimes into account because of A, its own incapacity, and B, its own unwillingness, and C, its general inefficiency.
But the analysts say, in spite of the threat of violence or even death, women are still pushing forward in both nations. In Afghanistan, where women vividly remember living under Taliban rule when they were punished for leaving the house without a male relative or showing even an inch of ankle, Nadri says women are fighting against legislation that would erode their rights.
In each of those battles, the Afghan women have fought back. They were on the street, they were on the Parliament House, they were at the office of president knocking on his door.
And in each of those battles, he says, the women won. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Islamabad.
Japan is sending 100 soldiers and radar to its westernmost outpost, a tropical island off of Taiwan, in a deployment that risks angering China with ties between Asia's biggest economies already hurt by a dispute over nearby islands they both claim. Japanese Defense Minister Itsunori Onodera will break ground on Saturday for a military lookout station on Yanaguni, which is home to 1,500 people and just 93 kilometers from the disputed Japanese-held islands claimed by China. The mini-militarization of Yonaguni, now defended by two police officers, is part of a long-standing plan to improve defense and surveillance in Japan's far-flung frontier. But the radar base on the island, which is much closer to China than to Japan's main islands, could extend Japanese monitoring to the Chinese mainland and track Chinese ships and aircraft circling the disputed crags called the Senkuku by the Japanese and the Daiyu by China. The 11-square-mile backwater, known for strong rice liquor, cattle, sugarcane, and scuba diving, may seem an unlikely place for Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to put boots on the ground, but Yonaguni marks the confluence of the Japanese defense establishment's concerns about the vulnerability of the country's thousands of islands and the perceived threat from China. 119 years ago this week, a defeated China signed a humiliating treaty with Japan, ending the First Sino-Japanese War. The Treaty of Shimonoseki, named after the Japanese city in which it was signed, ceded key territories and rights to Japan. There are echoes from the treaty even today in the diplomatic and economic competition between Japan and China. VOA's Dave DeForest asked Duke University professor Leo Ching about the provisions of the treaty.
Number one is, of course, China has to cede Taiwan or Formosa to Japan, and including all these other islands, and of course, the contested Diaoyu, Senkaku Islands were also included in this treaty. The second important thing, I think, is the Chinese Empire had to agree to gain independence for Korea. And the third is for the Japanese to gain what was called the most favored nation status, which allows Japan to create some kind of unequal treaty of trading, opening ports to Japan, much like the Western nations. I think that the Treaty of Shimonoseki, what it has brought is this radical shift in East Asia from a kind of Sino-centric imperial empire to that of a kind of Western nation-based imperialism. So what we have is really a shift from what we might call empire in the imperial sense, which is based on tribute system, based on a Chinese worldview, to that of a very much a nation-based capitalist and colonial power that sort of symptomatic of turn of the century of the what we call the age of neo-imperialism.
Now, you mentioned some islands that are currently in dispute today, islets really. Is this the point at which Japan gets control of those and is to this day claiming that those islands are its territory?
Basically, the island were used as a kind of a navigation point. While it appeared on several maps, in Chinese maps, Japanese map, and so on and so forth, no one actually really claimed sovereignty over those islands.
At this point, Korea then becomes territory of Japan, is that right? Or was there some interim administration?
In 1905, just 10 years after the treaty, Japan proclaimed Korea as a kind of protectorate.
Can you talk a little bit more about the legacy of the treaty, things that were decided back there in 1895 that are currently vibrating through the political systems of that area?
Right. So one of the often talked about issue about the treaty is that it inaugurated or further instilled this sense of humiliation in modern Chinese history. The word that it's used often to describe the ceding of Taiwan or Formosa to Japan from China is this Chinese word called 割让, or literally translated into cutting and yielding. So the idea is that somehow Taiwan has always belonged to the body of this larger notion of China, and by ceding Taiwan to a foreign country, this was sort of basically for China to cut part of itself. This treaty saw the emergence of Japan in a way replacing China in East Asia as the only superpower. And I think we have to remember that unlike Europe, there has never been the coexistence of two superpowers in Asia. So I see this treaty as enabled us to see not only the shift in East Asia as it developed in the modern period, but we are also seeing the resurgence of China right back into the kind of world stage, and how I think the Sino-Japanese relationship play out in the future will really affect not just the region, but the world as a whole.
Leo Ching, a professor of Japanese culture studies at Duke University, spoke with Dave DeForest. Thank you for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia. Our studio director is Patrice Michael. I'm Terry Wing.
Hi, I'm David Byrne.
And I'm Lin Yang.
I'm Aisha Holly.
And I'm Madeline Ack.
We're the hosts of VOA's Now.
We'll be bringing you stories that interest you.
Join the conversation
every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday,
beginning April 28th, for the Voice of America's Now.